What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
Carl Jung, the psychoanalyst, said that the fool was the precursor to the savior from a mythological perspective. And you can see an echo of that in the idea that comedians tell the truth, right? And that the jester in the king's court is the only one, because he's beneath contempt, he's the only one that can actually say what's true. And so that's the sort of thing that Jung meant. But it's also the case that the reason the fool is the precursor to the savior is because when you first start to think, you have to express yourself badly and as if you're ignorant, because you don't know how to talk or think, and you are ignorant. And so what that means is that if you're not allowed to think badly, and then you can't think at all. You can never learn to think at all. And so that's part of why the restrictions on free speech are so indefensible, because everyone starts out foolish and ignorant. And the part of the Enlightenment idea, and I would say even more deeply rooted ideas before that that had been developing for centuries, is that people are at least capable of moving towards enlightenment, even though they're not there and they never will be there. It's possible to stumble forward towards enlightenment. And you can't also do that just by thinking by yourself, because you're just not smart enough to think by yourself. And so free speech isn't merely the right to criticize those in power, and it's often viewed that way. And it's not also only the right to say what you think, it is actually the right to think. Because even what we're doing right now is thinking, you know, so like I'm talking to you guys, and you might say, well, you're not involved in the conversation, but that's not true, because I'm watching you to see if I'm on the right wavelength, you know, if my words are hitting their intended target, and I'm trying to make sure that I construct my language so that the communicative intent is where I want it to be. And that's all a process of active thought. And that's what clarifies your spirit and improves your behavior and ennobles you across time. And so it isn't that free speech is a value. It's not that. It's a canonical value. Without that, all the other values that we hold dear, that people have fought so hard to, and so in such an unlikely manner to preserve and produce, that all disappears. And you end up with a populace that is not only afraid to say what they think, but that doesn't even know what they think, because they haven't been allowed to stumble around in the dark like human beings have to do in order to find some tiny fragment of light. You know, part of wisdom is knowing what to be afraid of. And many times, many, many times in your life, perhaps with every important choice you make, you've got terror on one side and terror on the other. There's no way forward that doesn't involve risk. And see, there's a big problem with self-censorship. And that is that every time you fail to express who and what you are in an articulated manner, you first of all lose an opportunity to know yourself better. And that's not good, because you have to pilot yourself through life, and life is a very dangerous and treacherous enterprise. And if you don't know yourself well, then you won't pilot yourself well, and you will be hurt more often than you need to be. And that is not trivial. But the other thing is that you also weaken yourself. And I'm speaking as a clinical psychologist here, and I don't think there's any doubt about this, is that, you know, Your mind is basically wired up in many, many different ways to determine what constitutes a valid threat. And that's not an easy thing to figure out. Like if you wake up in the morning and your side is sore you know, does that mean you pulled a muscle or does it mean you have cancer? It's like, you don't know. You can't tell. It's very difficult to determine exactly how threatening a threat is. And one of the ways that your brain figures that out is to watch you. And it assumes that if you move away from something, if you retreat from something, it assumes that the thing that you're retreating from is bigger than you and that you're smaller than it. And so it makes you just that much more existentially weak and frightened. And so when you have something to say and you don't say it, then not only do you miss an opportunity to articulate yourself properly, which is really fundamentally necessary, but you tell yourself right down to the level of your soul that there's less of you than there could be. And that makes the next retreat even more likely. And so you can easily initiate a positive feedback loop where you retreat and you get a little smaller and your enemy gets a little bigger. And then you retreat again and you get a little smaller and your enemy gets a little bigger. And then you're at a point where even under each time you retreat, for success in life, it's a recipe for cowering in the corner and freezing. And so, you know, you might be afraid to say what you have to say, and you might have every reason to be afraid, but you should even be more afraid of not saying what you have to say, because the consequences of that, as they accrue over the long term, are they'll undermine everything for you. They'll undermine your faith in yourself, they'll undermine your family, they'll undermine your society. That is not a place you want to go. This is something else you need to know, and there's a very solid literature on this, is that, you know, one of the most ancient ideas that human beings have had is that in some manner our spirits speak being into existence, you know, and it's like the hallmark of consciousness, and it's one of the reasons that individuals are valuable, and it's a very deep idea and a very necessary idea, and I believe one that's fundamentally true, but it carries with it certain more mortal perils, you might say. If you falsify your speech in the service of a proximal goal, you corrupt your soul. And, or I could say more technically, that you damage your psyche. Those are very similar ideas. But the evidence for that is crystal clear. You know, because what happens to people who say things they don't believe is they come to believe the things they say. And the reason for that is, We talked a little earlier about the fact that a lot of you is unarticulated, right? And so there are things you know, but you don't know that you know them, and you don't know how to talk about them. And so then what you do is you decide that to reach a proximal goal, like getting a good grade, well, you have to say what the professor wants. So you write out an essay. You know, there's no soul in it, and you feel sick while you're writing it, and you're not interested in it, and you feel small, which are all hints from your being that you shouldn't be doing that, but you do it anyways. And then at the end, you've got two choices. Like, you're either a liar and a coward, or you believe what you wrote. And there's plenty of psychological evidence for this. And what people do is decide that they believe what they wrote, because it's less painful than noting that you're a liar and a coward. And not only that, you've articulated a counter-argument. And so your original conviction remains unarticulated, and the counter-argument is articulated. So you've built yourself your own enemy, and you will pay for that. You pay for that with a diminishment of your character, and your character is what sustains you through life. There isn't, you don't have, in any fundamental sense, you don't have anything else, because that's the thing that enables you to master the continual onslaught of chaos and uncertainty that you will be faced with for your entire life. You do not pollute your character. You pay for it. And so does everyone else. And if it goes far enough, then everyone else pays horribly for it. And it's the lesson of the 20th century. So don't do that. And if you do that at university, it's like a mortal sin. It runs absolutely contrary to the spirit of the institution. It is precisely the opposite to, it's the absolute polar opposite to why you're here. Do not do it. And it's also a kind of second-rate cynicism, because even though there is a fair bit of rot in the academic institutions, most of the time, if you write an articulate essay, that the professor doesn't agree with, you will not be punished with a failing grade. It's very rare that that actually happens. Now, there is the odd professor who's so damn corrupt that that's going to be the case, but I've talked to lots of students and counseled them to write down what they think, and their grade generally surprises them quite spectacularly because they're invested in the damn essay, and so they do the work, right? And they put a little passion into it, and they're not bored by it or made sick by what they're producing. And then they end up with a grade that's far better than they think. So, you know, often it's a, well, I'm going to take the easy route out, but I'm going to justify it by relating it to my career progress. It's like, really, guys, that's pretty pathetic. You know, seriously, it's pathetic. And I don't mean to be morally judgmental. I mean that it's pathetic in that what it will do is make you weak and craven. And probably you don't want that. You know, like, why would you want that when you could be strong and forthright instead? Like, that's a way better choice. So don't say things that you don't believe, and especially don't write things. Well, part of what makes people peaceful, because we like to think we're peaceful, but we're not. We're neither peaceful nor anxiety-free. In fact, I would say that the normative human being is just as much terrified and murderous as calm and collected. Everything has to be right for you to be calm and collected. Now, the reason you and I can sit here and talk is because we share a very large number of assumptions. And so I don't really see you. I see this facade for this time that you're manifesting out of politeness and because you're socialized.
Yeah.
And you see that of me. And that means that we're two primates who can sit here and have a discussion without it breaking down into anything resembling, say, violence.
Right. But
fantastic scene in a book by Dostoevsky called The Possessed or The Devils, which is a great book, by the way. It's one of the books that outlines where we're headed, I would say, even though it was written more than 100 years ago, because it's about people who are possessed by an ideology that's very much like the social justice ideology that's emerged again. There's one scene in there, I think the character's name is Stavrogin, but he's breaking down because these belief systems are starting to shift around and he isn't sure how to conceptualize himself. And at one point, I may have the character's name wrong, he goes into this club. You know, it's like an elite aristocratic club, like, and there's an old general sitting in there, and he grabs him by the nose and pulls him out onto the street, which, you know, in one sense it's not a particularly brutal thing to do, but it's such a violation, it was such a violation of the social norm that it just caused absolute outrage. And that's a good example. It's like, I wouldn't have to be particularly different, I wouldn't have to pull out a knife mm-hmm. in order to destabilize the conversation.
Right.
There's lots of subtly strange things that you could do or that I could do that would put a real undercurrent into the conversation. You can experience that sometimes if you ever happen to talk to someone who's psychopathic and you get a sense of that's actually what they're like. Mm-hmm. There's videos online of Paul Bernardo, and I would recommend that people take a look at those because they'll give you some sense of what can be bubbling underneath the surface.
Yeah.
So part of the reason that belief systems regulate people's emotions, aggression and fear, let's say, and disgust, many, many emotions, is because we act them out in the world. And as long as we're both acting out the same set of assumptions, then we can get what we want from each other because we can predict each other's behavior mm-hmm. and we can cooperate easily. We can even compete because we know the rules of competition. But if that shared structure starts to fall apart, then I don't know.
What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This fall in love with Cozy Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
What you're going to be like. The story of Adam and Eve is a meta story. And it's a meta story for two reasons. One is, it's about how stories transform. Because Adam and Eve are in this unconscious paradise and then it collapses. And that happens to every potential story, right? That's Nietzsche's realization. He said, look, imagine that you live within a belief system. And then something arises to challenge the belief system. Not only does the belief system collapse, but something worse happens. Your belief in belief systems collapses. And that's the road to nihilism. Now, it doesn't have to, because you can jump from one belief system to another. But sometimes that doesn't work, is that you do a meta critique and you say, oh, I was living in this protective structure and it turned out to be flawed. Okay, one alternative is jump to another protective structure. Fine. Another alternative is protective structures themselves are not to be trusted. Bang, you're in chaos. How the hell are you going to get out of that? That's the pathway to nihilism. Well, you can work your way through that. That's difficult. Or you can do what Jung would regard as a soul-damaging move, and you can sacrifice your new knowledge and re-identify with something rigid and restricted, which is what I would say is happening to some degree with the people in Europe who are turning to a regressive nationalism as an alternative to the current state of chaos. It's like, I know that people need to identify with local groups. I understand that. But that they risk the danger of making the state the ultimate god. And that's order, but that's not a good replacement for chaos. It's just another kind of catastrophe, right? Too much order, too much chaos. Both catastrophes. You want to stand in the middle somehow and mediate between the two. And that's where you have your real strength. Because then it isn't that you've discovered a safe place. Because even the bloody right-wingers are after a safe place, right? They just want it to be the state. Yeah, exactly. Well, there's no safe places. And the next issue is, do you really want a safe place? Is that what you want? You want to be so weak that you want to be protected from threat? What the hell kind of life is that? You're a paralyzed rabbit in a hole. That's no life for a human being. You should be confronting danger and the unknown and malevolence. And the reason for that, too, is this is the weird paradox. And I believe this is the paradox, first of all, that was discovered in part by Buddha, but also laid forth very clearly in Christianity, which is that the solution to the problem of tragedy and malevolence is the willingness to face them. Now, who the hell would ever guess that? It's a completely paradoxical suggestion. Is that, well, why does it work? Well, because the more you confront the two of them, the more you grow. And maybe you can grow so that you're actually larger than the chaos and malevolence itself. And you think, well, what's the evidence for that? And that's easy. That's what people do. That is how we learn. Like, every time you expose your child to something new, a playground, what are they exposed to? Chaos and malevolence. Now, there's more to it than that, obviously, because kids play and they promote each other and they form friendships and all of that. But in the playground itself, there is the complexity of the social structure and the malevolence of the bully. It's right there. And you throw your kid in there and you say, adapt. And they do. Okay, so they can do it at a small scale. It's not trivial. The playground's a complicated place. The kid can adapt. Well, how much can you scale that up? Can you scale that up from the chaos and order and malevolence of the playground to chaos and order and malevolence itself? Well, that's the question. Well, I don't think there's any reason to answer that in the negative. So, because we don't know the full extent of a human being. And it is the problem that's worked out. So, in the Buddha story, for example, what happens after So Buddha's world collapses in the same way that Adam and Eve's world collapses. It's a consequence of repetitive exposure to mortality and death. What happens to Buddha is he realizes that the little protected city that his father made for him, the walled garden, it's exactly the same motif that's in this Adam and Eve story, it's fatally flawed. That kind of protection cannot exist, and he discovers that in pieces, right? Which is exactly what happens to children, is that they go out, they discover a limit, they run back. And the parents can help them with the limit. They run out, they discover a limit, they run back. But at some point, they run out, they discover a limit, they run back, and the parents have nothing to say to them. Because they've hit the same limit that the parents hit. Which is like, well, what are you going to do with your life? How are you going to operate in this archetypal universe? Well, your parents can only say, well, they can say, you identify with the proper archetypal figures. They do that, they at least act that out for you. But at some point, it's a problem that they cannot solve for you without making you weaker. That's the thing, you know. So it's an interesting thing that I've learned in therapy, because one of the things you have to learn as a therapist is how do you not take your client's problems home with you. It's a very common existential problem that beginning therapists face, because they're afraid. It's like, well, you're dealing with people all the time who have serious problems. Sometimes it's mental illness, although less frequently than you'd think. And sometimes it's just that they're having a good catastrophe, right? Their parents have cancer or something like that, or their father has Alzheimer's and they're unemployed, or they have a drug problem, or they have a schizophrenic son, or like, these aren't mental illness problems, right? Those are just catastrophes. And so people are discussing those with you all the time. How do you avoid being crushed by that or avoid taking it home? And the answer to that is, you don't steal the problem. That's the answer. It's like, you have some problems. If you come and talk to me, I'll help you figure out how to solve them. I will not tell you how to solve them. I won't steal your problems. Because what we're trying to do in therapy is, number one, solve your problem. Number two, turn you into a great solver of problems. And the second one is way more important than the first one. And so you never solve someone's problem by removing from them the opportunity to solve their problem. That's theft. That's the Oedipal situation. That's the Oedipal situation. That's the overprotective mother. Now, father can play that role too. We're talking about archetypal representations. It's like, I'll protect you at the cost of your ability to protect yourself. No. Wrong. That's a sin. That's a good way of thinking about it. That is not what you do with people. Not with your children, not with your partner, not with yourself. You don't do that. That destroys people's adaptive competence. And it disarms them in the face of chaos and malevolence. And that's a terrible thing. You're going to send someone out unarmed in a world like that? It's a terrible thing to do. So, and if people aren't strong enough to manage it, then they get resentful. And then, you know, you get the downhill spiral that goes along with that. Okay, so the meta story is partly, you have a map, but it's insufficient and things will come up to disrupt it. And sometimes the disruption is catastrophic. Everything falls apart. That's what happens to the Buddha, and that's what happens to Adam and Eve. And the rest of the biblical stories are actually an attempt to put that back together. Now, that's been assembled, as I said, it's been assembled over centuries, right? Okay, we've got the problem. The problem is the apocalypse, the ever-present reality of the apocalyptic fall. That's the problem. And so you could say, well, what is that? It's the insufficiency of all potential conceptual schemes. Right. Your conceptual schemes are insufficient to deal with the complexity of the world. It's a permanent problem. So what do? You stop relying on your conceptual schemes. That's part of the answer. You start relying instead on your ability to actively generate conceptual schemes in the face of chaos and malevolence. And so that makes you someone that identifies with your creative capacity, your creative, courageous capacity for articulation and action in the face of the unknown, rather than some formulaic approach to the territory. The idea is that elevates your character to the point where you can withstand tragedy and malevolence without becoming corrupt. And that provides a permanent solution to the problem. Well, then you might say, cynically, what's your evidence that that's a permanent solution? And the answer to that is, well, the evidence isn't all in yet. First of all, because people only live that way partially. And so we haven't put the hypothesis to the full test. And second, we don't know what our limitations are. We have no idea what our limitations are.
and they're both greater and lesser than we imagined. Because you know, you have to ask yourself, like, if people stopped adding voluntarily to the misery of the world and devoted themselves to setting things straight, setting themselves straight and setting the things around them straight, what would happen? And the answer to that is, well, there'd be a hell of a lot less unnecessary misery in the world, so that might not be a bad place to start. But apart from that, there's very little that we can say. Could we overcome the catastrophe of mortality? Why not? You think that's beyond our capacity? Could we make the world a place where no one was suffering any more than necessary and still allow the world to exist? Well, possibly, because we don't know the limitations of our capacity. We're only running at 40%, if that, I would say. If we don't make full use of all the people that are in the world, we don't have our situation set up so that the gifts that they could offer to everyone are fully realized. We haven't set the systems up for that yet, so we waste people like mad, and then we waste ourselves like mad.
And the thing is that, you know, human beings are self-conscious, and we know about our limitations, and we know about our weaknesses. And so we can have contempt for human beings in general, because, you know, we're just flawed and breakable and all of that. But we know ourselves better than we know everyone else. And so, unless you're narcissistic, and some people are, then you have a very acute sense of how you're not up to scratch on many of the dimensions along which you could be evaluated, even by yourself. And so that leads naturally to a sort of self-contemptuous attitude. And you can see that one of the stories I talk about is that people are more likely to give prescription medication to their pets than to take them themselves. right, you know. So,
In the United States, because we're pretty over-medicated here.
Even in the United States, people will get the prescriptions, but they won't take the pills. Anyways, the idea there is, it's sort of a variation that I learned from Carl Jung on treat other people as you would like to be treated. It's you reverse that. It's like, imagine someone that you treat well, that you love, then try to treat yourself that way. You got to detach from yourself a bit. You got to think, okay, well, I'm a person among other people, and I deserve at least as much respect as a person among other people, and I should be trying to help myself across time. Instead of being self-contemptuous and self-destructive, I need to take care of myself as if I'm potentially valuable and to lay out my life that way. And so that's what that chapter is about. And it's hard for people, you know. They don't take care of themselves as well as they should. And I don't mean, you know, take care of yourself. I mean, that isn't what I mean. It's like, it's not a moralistic attack. It's like, it's an encouragement to give yourself a bit of the benefit of the doubt. It isn't clear where your borders actually are, you know. It means take care of your room, take care of your things, like have some respect for yourself as a miraculous being, because that is actually what you are. But, you know, that sort of borders on the New Age, which I'm not very happy about that, but it's still the case. It's like you are. There is a lot of potential within you, and there's many things that you can do, and you're necessary more than you think to the unfolding of things. Like, if you make a bunch of bad decisions, things get worse, not just for you. Like, things get worse, and maybe way worse. Like, I don't know what mistakes Stalin's mother made, you know, and she probably didn't necessarily think they were that important, but it turned out they were pretty important. You don't know how you're actions echo. And so it matters what you do. And so part of what you do is you want to treat yourself as if what you do matters. And so you want to have some respect for yourself and some fear of yourself. That's also that. And
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
Fall calls for comfort. Mack Weldon's got essentials designed for cool days and timeless style. Their new Ace line combines comfort with sophisticated looks. Go to MackWeldon.com for 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code MACK25.